This program was first broadcast on Canterbury's community access radio station Plains FM 96.9 and was made with the assistance of New Zealand On Air.
Coming up next, conversations on human rights with Speak Up, Kōrero Tia, here on Plains FM.
E nā mana, e nā reo, e nā hō e whā, tēnā koutou katoa, no mai ki tēne hōtaka. Speak Up, Kōrero Tia. Tune in as our guests Speak Up, sharing their unique and powerful experiences and opinions. And may you also be inspired to speak up when the moment's right. Nō mai, haere mai. Welcome to Speak Up Kōrero Tia. Ko Sally Carlton tēnei. I'm based in Christchurch. This is Sally Carlton, your host. Today's topic, something slightly different for us. We're going to be looking at organ harvesting. We've got three very interesting guests. We've got Jaya Gibson back again. Jaya, nice to see you back.
Yeah, thanks for having me back.
Here in the studio with us. And we've got Robin Palmer from South Africa via Skype today. He's based in Christchurch, but in South Africa at the moment. And also David Kilger. Now, if you guys could please...
Hi, Jay. It's long time no see, no speak.
Yes. I'm sorry I couldn't make it up up north. It's just a bit hectic at this time of year.
Okay.
Now, if you could all please introduce yourselves, that would be fantastic.
Why, Robin's the one who's the hero. Why don't we get him to go first?
Okay.
No, but not building me up here for no reason. Yeah, Robin Palmer. I'm a professor of law at the University of Canterbury in Christchurch. Prior to that, I spent 5 or 6 years as a specialist prosecutor prosecuting a case called Operation Life, which involved illegal organ harvesting between Israel, South Africa, and Brazil and Romania. And that case resulted in a couple of significant convictions, which had a significant dampening effect on the trade, especially in South Africa and Israel.
Wow. Immense congratulations on that.
Yeah, thank you very much.
My name is Jai Gibson. I've been involved in various aspects of researching organ harvesting alongside Ethan Gutman since 2006, and I specialized some investigation into the Tibetans, spending some time undercover in Dharamsala and some other places.
David Kilgore from Canada, and I'm a former prosecutor too, by the way, long time ago. And I like to think that prosecutors are ministers of justice on issues like this, and that what Robin did and what I'm doing was basically the same. We're trying to get unethical people to stop killing people in China, so that patients in New Zealand or Canada or wherever can have new hearts or lungs, I think we all find is that people somehow don't realize this is going on. It's been going on an industrial scale now since about 2001. We just put an update to two books that were written, and we've concluded that at an absolute minimum, 60,000 people are being murdered each year in China, so that wealthy Chinese and wealthy foreigners, organ tourists, we call them, can have new organs. And it's a large scale business, and it's one that we call a crime against humanity. We think it's despicable, and anybody that has anything to do with it, frankly, is despicable, whether they're in New Zealand or Canada or China.
David, how did you get those statistics?
Oh, well, actually, the 60,000 is an absolute minimum. We've looked at 800 hospitals in China very carefully. We've taken in our update, it's about a 700-page update. It's got 2,400 footnotes, about 2,200 of which are taken from government of China or hospitals or data within China. And there is, for example, there's the one hospital, the Tianjin Hospital, that's a large hospital. It itself, we're absolutely convinced, does a minimum of 7,000, 8,000, 9,000 transplants a year. So when the government of China says, "Oh, we only do 10,000 about 10,000 a year. We are answering. It's very clear in our report. Anybody who wants to look at it simply goes. You can go to endorganpillaging.org and get the whole report. It's absolutely, I think, clear that one hospital is doing 8,000 or 9,000 transplants. So, with 140 licensed hospitals in China to do transplants, it's clear that it's a minimum of 60,000 a year. And the thing that people try and argue, the defenders of the party state in China try to argue, is that these are voluntary donations. There's all kinds of things, but I'm sure Jaya and Robin and you all know that it's quite contrary to the culture in China to give organs, so that the amount of people who donate organs is minuscule. compared to the demand. So that what happens basically is that somebody goes from, let's say, Christchurch to China for an organ, and they go to the number one people's hospital in Shanghai often. Their blood and tissue types are taken. There's then there's a data bank, and it tells who matches whom. And if somebody is basically taken out of a work camp, I don't think they use the term work camp at the moment, but somebody's taken out of the equivalent of a forced labor camp, probably a Falun Gong practitioner, but it could be a Uyghur, it could be a Tibetan, it could be a house Christian, and that person has their lung or heart removed, and of course they're killed in the process. Their body is burned, and say it's a liver, is flown to Shanghai, and the person from New Zealand gets the new liver and flies back to here with a new liver, and maybe not realizing that somebody's been executed, murdered is really what it is, in order that they can have a new organ. And that's only the Nazis would have done something like that. They didn't have the technology in Hitler's time, but it's only comparable with what the Nazis or other genocide people who do genocide around the world would do. It's absolutely outrageous. And for us, for example, in New Zealand, to be having a free trade agreement with a country that does this, I mean, frankly, I just find it's incomprehensible that New Zealand would have a free trade agreement with people who treat the government that treats its own people this way. So we can talk about that, I'm sure. And forgive me for going on so long.
That's okay. One of my questions is, you mentioned this has been going on since 2001, possibly. Mm-hmm. And
not possibly. For certain, it's been going on since 2001.
But possibly earlier?
Pardon?
Possibly earlier, or can you pinpoint it to
2001? Well, no, yes, you're right. It did start earlier. In fact, Dr. Toti has given evidence that in the late 90s, he was in the Uyghur part of China, he was involved in a removal of an organ from a man who was being executed, and except they shot him in the right hand side of his chest rather than the left, so he was still alive when Toti took his organs out of his body. And you're right, it has been going on, but on a sort of larger and larger scale, it really started in 2001, and now it's been growing exponentially since 2001 to the point where it's an absolute minimum of 60,000 a year.
And my question is why are we talking about it now? What's the impetus for this discussion right now?
We've been talking about it for 10 years. Mm-hmm. And, you know, it's been very hard to get traction. We've China is a powerful economic force, and it's been difficult to engage governments openly. Not impossible. We've had some success. We're just talking about it because more needs to be done. We just need to keep the momentum going.
And I think there are other issues at play too. We're of course trying to get the government of China to stop doing this. David Matus and I have been in probably 50 countries now talking about this to the public, raising awareness to parliamentarians, to journalists, to academics. I was at a hospital yesterday, and we're trying to raise enough awareness that when any, for example, Chinese diplomat goes to a reception here in Auckland, he or she will be approached by people saying, "Why are you killing your own people?" And so at some point, I think soon the government of China is going to say this is costing us so much in goodwill around the world that we better stop doing it. On the other hand, we estimate that it's probably worth about $8 or $9 billion a year to people like the surgeons in China and the People's Liberation Army who fly the organs, that there's a huge incentive not to stop it. But I think naming and shaming actually is helping, and we've named and shamed the government of China now for long enough that I think they're just about the point where they keep talking about stopping it, but of course they don't do it. And I think enough of us raise the issue. If we, for example, if New Zealand were to pass a law saying that anyone who goes to buy, you don't have to say China, you just say anybody who buys an organ outside of New Zealand or inside New Zealand is guilty of an offense, I think that would discourage people from going to China. Two countries have done it. Taiwan has done it, and Israel have done it, and Spain has done a similar thing. But there are some countries that have done it. I would love to see New Zealand and Canada show some leadership on this and do the same.
Yeah, and one of the other reasons we're talking about it also is that there's a documentary that's being shown around New Zealand at the moment called Hard to Believe, we've had a number of sold out is the wrong word, mostly by invitation, but full screenings, and you can watch that online, and it comes from primarily a sort of a medical standpoint, and sort of discusses the issue around the doctors mostly. And it features a lot of doctors, a group of doctors called Doctors Against Forced Organ Harvesting, who are very active in trying to make the medical establishment more aware of the issue and to urge them, motivate them to take action where they can. So that's another reason we're talking about it right now. And it's a very current documentary, and it shows David Kilgour's evidence, Ethan Gutman's evidence. And others as well, and I'd urge you to go online and check that documentary out. It's very powerful.
By the way, Robin, we showed Human Harvest last night here in Auckland, and that film won a Peabody Award last year in the States, and that's been immensely helpful. The fact that it won this award, and there were a lot of people in New York when the presentation was made, that's helped a lot too. But people have to act. People, say, listening to us now, have to say, look, this is unacceptable, and they have to, as you just said, the other place they can go, Robin, they can go to endorganpillaging.org, as I mentioned, and you can see there are all kinds of things there that are mentioned that people can do. They can phone their MP, they can write letters, they can do all kinds of things. They can help us stop this crime against humanity.
That seems like a nice place to have our first break. And Robin, we're going to use your song. Was there a particular reason you chose this one?
Well, I just think the analogy between lying there waiting for abuse and waiting for your kidney to be removed is pretty close. So it sort of struck an analogous chord there.
Perfect.
Have you forgotten what it's like to lie away at night, hearing the footsteps in the hall coming down towards your door? No one who can help you, no one you can call. Have you forgotten what it's like? Have you forgotten what it's like to give?
No mai hoki mai, welcome back to Speak Up Kōrerotia. I'm Sally Carlton, and we're with Robin Palmer, Jayamangalam Gidson, and David Kilgour discussing organ harvesting. David got us talking in the last section about what's happening in China, and I know this is also happening in other parts of the world, so it would be great to get a sense of where is this happening, and do we have a sense of scale in addition to what's going on in China?
Can I just jump on Sally first, David?
Sure.
On that? We've been told by people in New Zealand that there are people from New Zealand that are going to China for organs. I completely accept that this is happening elsewhere in the world, but there's a fundamental difference. If you go to, say, country X, and you get a kidney, the so-called donor is still alive because he or she probably gives you cells part of the kidney. What happens in China is they take both kidneys and the person is dead. I often use the example of I talked to him, a man from Taiwan who went to China and because he needed a new kidney because he had hepatitis, and he basically took 8 sets of kidneys that were brought to him to his hospital bed before a kidney was compatible with his blood and tissue type and so on. So 8 human beings were murdered so that this guy could have a new kidney. Now, he feels terrible about it now, but it's a bit late for the 8 people who are dead. And as I say, I can't make the point strongly enough that there's only one place in the world, to my knowledge, where the government is involved to this up to its armpits in what's going on. In fact, they set up the system, and from top to bottom, the whole system is run by the government of China. And everywhere else it happens, it's in back alleys, and it's done. The donors aren't killed in the process. They sell part of a liver or part of a kidney. But this is fundamentally different. It's only country, 196 countries in the world where this happens, and that's what we keep stressing to people is just simply New Zealand, for example, could pass a law saying that nobody from New Zealand can buy a trafficked organ within New Zealand, which I'm sure is the law now, or outside New Zealand, basically giving the law extraterritorial effect, and that would stop it, as it stopped people from Taiwan going to China, and a lot of them were going before, and it stopped people from Israel going, and a lot of them were going before too. So why can't New Zealand show leadership on this matter? And I wish I could say, why can't Canada do it? And we're pushing hard to get a similar law in Canada.
Thank you for clarifying that.
Robin, do you want to tell us from your perspective what...
Well, as David says, what's happening in most of the world and what's happening in China are two completely different moral planes. On the one hand, you have organ executions on demand, and in most other places in the world, you have organ sales, which are illegal in terms of the country's laws, but certainly not on the level of planned organ executions, which makes this particularly outrageous. And I think perhaps I can just add, I think what is starting to happen and what needs to happen is to move from incidental campaigns to a broad-based campaign based on general moral outrage, that people can nod and wink at the fact that a state can sponsor planned organ executions to order. And nobody cares that much about it because of economic power. This is outrageous, and it's something that needs to be attacked on a broad scale.
Yeah, it's an interesting conundrum. It's so abhorrent, this practice. But I think, over the years, the sense of helplessness, and I think this is relevant to a lot of global issues at the moment, is this sort of sense of powerlessness. When you talk to people about it, they're like, this is terrible, but, what can I do about it? And they're so removed from that experience, that culture that could even produce that. So I think there's a large barrier to get over. But you're right, I think a much more sort of widespread global campaign would be very useful.
Well, we're trying to do that with our new website. It's called the International Coalition to End Organ Pillaging. That's the one I keep mentioning. And I think we're having amazing success. And I think, as Robin mentioned, the Doctors Against Forced Organ Harvesting are doing phenomenal work on this. In fact, they've been nominated for the Nobel Peace Prize this year. But, it's interesting. And there's not much humor in the subject at all, but one of the things that this week that happened that was perhaps a little bit funny was that David Matus and I went to Canberra And we did a sort of a 15-minute interview with a journalist from Associated Press. And sure enough, the article appeared the next day. And I think I looked this morning on Google, and it's now been in more than 100 newspapers around the world, in India, in New York Times, in Canada. I think I saw a couple from New Zealand. But as far as I could see, there was virtually no newspaper in Australia that carried the article. I was here 5 or 6 years ago, and we had a press conference, and somebody from the Post came, the Dominion Post, and they had photographers there, and they had apparently one of their most senior journalists there, and we spent quite a long time doing this, and yet the next day there was not a single word in the Post about this matter. Now, is this because some daffy editor said, oh, we mustn't upset China by reporting something that's a matter of life and death to people? Another thing I learned, I was in Japan fairly recently, or in fact about a week ago, and I learned there that at least one MP in Japan has been told that if he raises this issue, the doctors in his district will stop supporting him. And then someone else in Japan told me that, well, in Japan, some doctors, and I mustn't say all, some doctors put the well-being of their patients ahead of the so-called donors in China. In other words, they put their patient having a new liver or kidney ahead of the fact that someone's going to, and in all likelihood, it's a prisoner of conscience who's been convicted of no crime and is sent to a forced labor camp on a police signature for up to 3 years, where they work, by the way, making things like McDonald's toys and Christmas decorations. We're getting close to Christmas and this kind of stuff. And it's simply inhuman that a doctor could say, my patient's well-being is more important than a human life in China. I mean, what kind of a world are we living in when doctors in any country would take that attitude, or any doctor would take that attitude? But please, Robin and Jaya, please give your view.
Well, I think the website that Ethan and the two Davids are working on is great. I think we here in New Zealand, you know, to make it more relevant to the listeners here, is that we've started a round table in Wellington with several interested parties from the medical, the political, the activist movement, getting together to discuss what we can do here politically, and understanding the sort of the complex political environment here with the New Zealand's very strong relationship with China and China's very sort of overbearing presence here. And I think the first roundtable that Robin and I were a part of was very positive, very productive, very robust discussion. And there was some discussion about the term organ pillaging as opposed to organ executions. And I think what that highlighted to me is that whilst we need a global coalition, I think that we have to recognize this sort of the cultural nuances, so that the languaging and messaging perhaps needs to be slightly adjusted according to the province, according to the country or culture. But there still needs to be a sort of, if we are going to have a strong global effect, I think there needs to be an agreement on global messaging and then local messaging. So, we've just started this conversation in New Zealand. I think there was definitely a will to carry on. I'm looking forward to meeting up with you, Robin, and discussing what we can do here locally. I think having some kind of legislation that pressures, medical doctors rather than demonizing or vilifying other victims, or the people that get the organs. I think the pressure should be put on the doctors rather than those who are getting the organs as such. I think certainly in this culture here, I think there would be a sort of reticence to do that, to punish the patient, as it were.
And
how do you mean punish the patient? What do you mean by this? Oh, you mean the person that goes, we shouldn't be too hard on them because they didn't know what was happening or something?
Well, I think there would normally be someone who would be an intermediary for that person, either a doctor or a broker, and I think the pressure should be put on them rather than, you know, the medical establishment.
Absolutely agree. Well said.
Yeah. I think.
And Robin, go ahead, please.
Robin, you feel strongly in that department too, don't you?
We did discuss it, and I think the focus of the pressure should be on the transplant associations, who in many cases relax in willful blindness, knowing what's going on, but then often give platitudes such as, well, it hasn't been reported since 2015, how do we know it's still going on, which are ridiculous logical statements to make. But having said that, it's one thing when your child is sick and you illegally buy a kidney from a willing seller. It's quite another thing if you are aware that somebody is going to be murdered in order to give your child that kidney. And we use the criminal law quite innovatively in South Africa in the Operation Life case. We prosecuted on many fronts for fraud, in terms of the Human Tissue Act, and various innovative prosecutions which were very effective. And in my view, in most countries' criminal law systems, if you are giving a kidney, if you are arranging to have a kidney transplant at a hospital known to facilitate organ executions, then you are part of a conspiracy to murder. And
Absolutely.
There's nothing stopping somebody in New Zealand or a local country from prosecuting you for participating in that murder because you're facilitating a murder to get a kidney. So I think some innovative prosecutions could be effective in this regard as well. Said that, I still think the focus of public pressure should be on the doctors and transplant associations who know what's going on.
Yeah, absolutely. I think a lot of the times patients can be ignorant, whether willful or not, to the ramifications of their treatment. Quite often they don't want to know, they just want to get better. I think it's an interesting point you bring up, Robin.
Well, yeah, Robin, I can hardly wait to meet you. I'm entranced by what you say and agree with you fully. The Transplantation Society had their annual or semi-annual meeting in Hong Kong, as you probably both know, recently, and David Matus and I went to it, and there were about 4,000 transplant surgeons there from all over the world. We had some fascinating chats with some of them, and two of the outgoing president and the former president of the Transplantation Society are both Australians. And if you can believe it, our report came out, this 700-page report, and Dr. Chapman from Australia said something like, it's all Falun Gong material. In other words, he hadn't read a page of it. He just thought he would slander the Falun Gong community by making an absolutely dumb statement like this. And by the way, David Matus and I are not Falun Gong practitioners. To blame the victims and the fact that, as I'm sure your listeners know, that the Falun Gong community has been demonized in the media across China for about June of 1999, demonized by the point way to the point that a friend of mine was in Beijing with her mother several years ago, and they had a guide. And as they were going along, somehow Falun Gong came up, and the guy said, oh, Falun Gong, they eat their children, don't they? So that's the level of demonization that goes on. The Falun Gong are subhuman. Ironically, we've learned that before this war was declared on them in June of 99, there were people from the party, academics, military, diplomatics, the Communist Party members were practitioners of Falun Gong. But because one besotted president of the country, Jiang Zemin, decided to declare war on Falun Gong, thousands and thousands of Falun Gong practitioners have been killed. And it's unimaginable that this should be happening in the 21st century. And it's got to stop. And people keep saying, well, President Xi Jinping isn't directly linked to it, so he could stop it. But he hasn't done anything about it so far, and I wish he would. It would be a very he'd get praise from a lot of us if he would do it. But he hasn't even lifted a finger to stop the persecution of Falun Gong so far. Yeah, it's a long subject, and I wish the Transplantation Society would show more leadership on this issue instead of just reflecting the views of a fellow called Wang Jiafu, who's the spokesperson for the government of China on this. And the leadership of the Transplantation, unfortunately, Society tends to just say yes sir, no sir to Mr. Wang Jiafu.
That sounds like a good spot to move into our next song. And I think then we'll pick up this idea you're getting into, David, about what's being done or not being done in terms of addressing the issue. Welcome back to Speak Up Korero Tia. We're talking about organ harvesting with Jayamangalam Gidson, David Kilgore, and Robin Palmer. And David was just getting into some of the things that people are or aren't doing to address the issue. Perhaps we'll pick up where we were heading. What are some things that are being done?
I think one of the things that's being done, forgive me for referring to it again and again, but this is this new international coalition against forced organ harvesting. That's new. We've had lawyers doing it. We've had doctors doing it brilliantly under Doctors Against Forced Organ Harvesting. But I think we're trying to give a role to everyone who's concerned about the issue, and that's why we've set up this. The website is in Stockholm, Sweden, but anybody can contact it. endorganpillaging.org, and they can go down the list and they can see, you know, what would you like to do? Would you like to do research? Would you like to do writing letters? Would you like to contacting MPs? There's a role for all of us in this, and nobody's more important than anybody else. We're all together, the international coalition. We're all trying to work together to get the party state in China to stop this hideous crime against humanity. And so that's one initiative that's been done. The legislation has been mentioned, that two countries that have done the best job on that are Taiwan and Israel and Spain as well. But making it illegal for people to travel to China to get organs that are unethically sourced. We could have a forum on when people land in New Zealand or in Canada, they could have a form saying, have you ever been involved in organ issue transplants? Now, of course, a lot of the people, the surgeons, for example, coming from China will not tell the truth on that, but at least it sends a signal to them that this is unacceptable and that it's possible maybe that some of these doctors will face the International Criminal Court one day. That would probably be a major disincentive for them to do it. Now, there's a more tricky one. If you say to somebody who's been to China for an organ that they can't get aftercare, I don't think we're saying that. I hope that New Zealand won't do that, and I hope that Canada won't do that. But at least we can say that you will know that you're taking part in an unethical crime is what you're taking part in, and we're not going to, you know, throw you out on the street and say you can't get aftercare, but the government of New Zealand or Canada or other, hopefully many other countries, will have taken a position on this. By the way, Taiwan also tells doctors if they have any part in this, they can lose their licenses. I'm told a country, if you don't mind, I won't give the name, but some people found the other day that of about 1,000 transplants received in that hospital, about 300 of them came from China. So we raised a real fuss with them about this, and they've agreed that if we won't name the hospital and the doctors, that they will stop this practice immediately of sending their patients to China. So, I mean, there's a huge amount of stuff can do. Just making people aware of it. Talk to your...
I think one of the good things... I think a good thing that people could do that might, be quite inspirational is hosting a screening. You know, if you have a community group that has an interest, medical students, I think, for example, mm-hmm. That would be a good thing to do is if you get in touch, with endpillaging.org, and you can get the license to screen either Hard to Believe or Human Harvest. I think that would be a really good way of spreading the word. I think the that medium is very powerful.
Absolutely agree with you, Rob. Absolutely agree.
I also think that the benefit in doing those sorts of screenings is it allows people in a forum to discuss the issues. And I think there's a healthy amount of skepticism about this issue. And having people there who can talk to it, I think, is quite useful.
Yeah, can we talk about that skepticism a bit?
Mm.
Because I've discovered this in many places, and normally you find that the people who are skeptical are the ones who have a conflict or a professional interest in not having people believe that it's happening. And if you push them a little bit and you say, what are you skeptical about? I mean, in our original book, as Robin and Jay know, we had, I think, 32 kinds of evidence that it was happening. People say, well, have you seen it happening? Do they expect us to be in the operating room when it's going on? Here's a bit of humor. After this was reported way back in 2006 in a place called Sujiaten in China, the American consul sent over some people from their consulate to Sujiaten to look at the operating rooms. I think it was 3 weeks after these leaks were made that they got there, and guess what they found? Nothing. So they reported back they'd found nothing suspicious. And what I think what I'm trying to say is that the people who are skeptical usually find that they have an interest in debunking this evidence. But if you look at it seriously, there's absolutely no doubt in anybody's mind. Let me give you one of the 32 kinds of evidence. The lady who started this whole thing going is. Her husband was a neurosurgeon in Sujiaten, China. He told her that he had removed the corneas from the eyes of 2,000. Imagine, 2,000 Falun Gong practitioners over 2001, 2003. He was having nightmares. He couldn't sleep. So finally she said, you've got to stop doing this. And he did stop. And, by the way, he also told her that after he removed the corneas, the people were still alive, of course, and they were taken into other operating rooms, and all of their organs were taken, and bodies were burned. But he was paid the equivalent of hundreds of thousands of U.S. dollars for this 2 year period, and he's left China, and she's left China, and so that's one. And if you think she's making all this up, and I was a prosecutor for 10 years, I spent a lot of time with her going over her story and pushing her on things and trying to. And it's in our stories. Her story is in the book, by the way, and it's called Sujiaten, the chapter. And she was, I think, she was honestly trying to help what happened. But people will say, oh well, she's got a conflict, or she's not believable, or whatever. So if you don't like that one, go to the other 31 kinds of evidence. But now we've got this update, which is a very systematic. A huge amount of work went into it, and we basically used the records from hospital websites in China, from amounts of revenues that are going to hospitals for transplants, a whole lot of data from within China to show, I think, beyond any doubt that this is now an industrial-scale operation that's going on in China. So when somebody comes along from the Transplantation Society, as they did recently at a press conference in Beijing, and says, look, oh, we went to look at some hospitals. Yes, they did. Apparently they went to, what, 4 hospitals? And guess what? They found nothing. And so they came out and they said to the world, or anybody would believe them, and I hope nobody will believe them, that, yeah, everything's fine now in China. Nothing is happening anymore. Well, please, give us a break. We're not stupid. The world, people are a lot smarter than the leadership of the Transplantation Society thinks they are.
David, you mentioned the story of the person who was performing these surgeries, and mm-hmm. and that person and also his wife have left China. Mm-hmm. And mm-hmm. I imagine one of the difficulties around this is finding people to testify, given there must be some serious consequences if they can't, for example, get out.
Oh, absolutely. Absolutely so. But Sally, we've talked to people who did manage to get out of the work camps. Not very many, but we've been to 15 countries where they managed to get out of the work camps and out of China. But you're right, people inside China, it's terribly difficult for them. And of the 15 or so people we talked to, we learned people who had been in the camps, had been tested every 3 months. And again, it's interesting that only the Falun Gong practitioners are tested in these camps medically. The other prisoners or the other people in the camps aren't tested. And the reason, again, is made obvious.
Well, actually, and David, that's interesting you say that because, I spoke to some 200 Tibetans while I was in Dharamsala, and they were tested every 3 months also, and there was evidence of Falun Gong and Tibetan monks being placed in the same facility in Sichuan.
Oh, I see.
And okay. I have, overwhelming evidence of systematic blood taking and recording throughout Tibet.
Okay, so sorry, I should have made it clear. I wasn't speaking about Tibet or Sichuan, the province you were talking. I'm talking about other parts of China where I guess there were not Tibetans. So I'm not rebutting what you're saying. It's just that in the camps that we've talked to people who were not Tibetans there.
Thanks. Robin, you might be a good person to answer this. I know that you've mentioned that Taiwan, Israel, and Spain have got good legislation. Is there a reason why those three countries are leading the way?
Yeah, I think David investigated that and can speak to that. I think it's basically they were shamed by the evidence, or they allowed themselves to be shamed by the evidence. And there's one guy in Israel in particular who took the lead. Because Israel was one of the countries which supplied through their medical aid facilities and not wink wink by the government, supplied patients to South Africa to receive Brazilian kidneys. So that's since 2009 or 2009, I think they are adhering to the new protocol. So, but I think one thing that we have to be careful of. Is this constant reversion to the straw man argument of the Falun Gong or the Tibetans or the Christians or the Uyghurs. That's all irrelevant in the sense of what's happening. The reason is that if we took them out of the equation completely, the Falun Gong and all the people who have been detained and not even been convicted, and they were just executing convicted criminals to do this, it would be just as morally outrageous. The fact that they are actually solving a double problem at the same time, getting rid of dissidents and supplying the organs and making money out of it, and those organs, of course, are more desirable because they tend to be healthier suppliers than the average criminal would be. But the point is, take the religious element or the groups that are particularly targeted out of the equation completely and say, forget about that and just look at the executions. If they were just taking prisoners and executing them on demand for organs, that would be outrageous. What makes it doubly outrageous is they are taking dissidents who haven't been convicted in a crime of any sort and are getting rid of dissidents by actually taking their organs and murdering them in the process.
Yeah, it's the typical ad hominem, is attack, demonize the person, attack the person to avoid the argument, sort of on a mass scale. And it's a well-used tactic by, kind of despot regimes and whatnot for continuing their abuse of minorities.
Completely agree with what you've both said. One thing that, again, I'm sure you're aware, is the number of executions, thank goodness, in China are going down. But in fact, the number of transplanted organs are going up. So that as the number of people who have been convicted of offenses, but I'm told there are 58 offenses in China, by the way, which are capital offenses, or were. I think the number's gone down a bit now. so that the demand for organs is going up, and therefore more Falun Gong and other prisoners of conscience, Tibetans, Uyghurs, or House Christians is going up. Somebody mentioned, what about Taiwan? And you might all be interested to know that the mayor of Taipei now is a transplant surgeon by the name of Ko, K-O. And Dr. Ko was actually in China trying to find out where the organs were coming from. And in the city, I forget the name of it, where he was told by the transplant surgeons there that that all of the so-called donors in that city were Falun Gong practitioners. So he came back and he gave an interview to Ethan Guttman, and this interview ended up in Guttman's book called The Slaughter, which came out in 2014. Dr. Ko is not taking part in any of these things. He's a very admirable person, and I'm happy to tell you that he won the election for mayor of Taipei by, I think it was 700,000 votes. So he's a good guy, and he's helped Ethan Guttman's research on his book a lot. But that's all you have to say about that.
Another interesting element to add to the Taiwanese story by the sounds of it. Mm-hmm. Okay, we're going to have our final song, which is David's choice of John Denver, Blowing in the Wind.
How many times must a man look up before he can see the sky?
And welcome back to Speak Up Cordero Tia. We're talking about organ harvesting, and David, you might be the person to kick us off thinking about what are some of the parliamentary actions that are taking place around the world.
Well, there have been some very good resolutions. There was one in 2013 in the European Parliament. There was one, more recently last year. The UN Committee on Torture has done some very good work. But what the problem we face is that most of the research has been done by independent volunteers, and I guess all three of us are independent volunteers. So we would be good if the UN group or a European group or a parliament of New Zealand or Australia or Canada would do something. And we're certain they would come to the same conclusions that we've come to. And we've asked Amnesty International to do a study, and they now handle this out of Hong Kong, and they don't have the resources to do their own investigation, but they've certainly joined with us in calling for an investigation of the matter. So that would help. Because what happens, and maybe I better not mention the country, but I was with the foreign ministry of a country fairly recently, and the diplomat looked at me and said, "We have doubts about your evidence." Well, yeah, what doubts? but he said, until the United States and Canada and Britain say that this is happening, we have doubts about your evidence. We can't accept your conclusions. So it would be good to have other people doing investigations.
Yeah, so it would be really good to see, you know, a multi-agency approach. And I think as individual investigators, we've just been doing what we can do, and that's mostly research and sort of, you know, traveling around and talking to people, but we really need to get sort of more sophisticated now. And I think, you know, in New Zealand, this round table could be, you know, the first step in doing that. And you know, if there's anyone out there that's interested in getting involved in New Zealand, that, you know, perhaps contact the radio show and Sally can put in touch with us.
Yeah, sure. I'm also thinking there are probably quite a few barriers, political will, apathy, skepticism we talked about before, trying to get people involved.
Yeah, absolutely. Mm. Like I said, it's just that having something so culturally and geophysically removed. I think there are a lot of sort of cultural barriers to overcome. But like I say, I think the most effective method for doing that is the documentaries. I really feel that they have the most power to move people. So I encourage people to go out there and see it themselves. It's available for free, but you know, if you could host a screening, I think that would really help. But the medical students are showing it to your local politicians, you know, inviting dignitaries, that kind of stuff, anyone you know that might hold an important position, you know.
Yeah, and things are changing. I was in Seoul recently, South Korea, and we tried to go to a hospital in Seoul a couple of years ago, and they wouldn't let us in the building. And this time, the doctors hosted the conference, the students came, and the medical and law students came, and they showed the human harvest. So, as you were saying, this is we are making steps, Robin and JR, and we have to make a lot more steps. Frankly, I think we have to do more in New Zealand and Australia.
I agree with you. I do think there is progress. I think, you know, China, 10 years was just, especially with the Olympics coming up, was just sort of coming out as a more global country, and I think people were a bit worried, about what power they would wield and how they would react in international situations. But I think now people are beginning to realize they're just another country. They just have, you know, they actually have a lot of the same issues as other countries, and they can't just, that a lot of their, their sort of bullying tactics are more more bluster than bite. And I think that people are beginning to realize that is the case, and are feeling a bit more confident in speaking out. And hopefully that's a trend that continues and speeds up.
Somebody was complaining last night at the showing we had here in Auckland about the number of jobs in New Zealand. And one of the things that doesn't seem to be understood is that I think the figure for the United States is 20 million manufacturing jobs have been lost in the United States over the last two decades, and about 50,000 manufacturing plants. That's a lot of families, a lot of livelihoods, a lot of people's, you know, well-being affected. And believe me, I'm not a supporter of Donald Trump, but one of his advisors, Peter Navarro, who's a PhD from Harvard, has actually gone over to Trump's side because of this. What's happened to the American economy? What's happened to the American people? And I'm sure it's happened to New Zealanders and Canadians and everywhere else. The government of China cheats so profoundly on its agreements, including its agreement under the World Trade Organization, that primarily by keeping their currency at a level where it gives them a huge advantage over everybody else. And those, remember when the G20 meeting was held recently in China? You may have noticed that they closed the economy, they stopped the economy for a week there, so it would look like there wasn't too much pollution. But I happened to notice that there were 200 steel plants closed down in that particular city. And if I'm not mistaken, it's about 20 steel plants in the United States are in bankruptcy protection. So it's not just the human rights involved. It's people's livelihoods and people's right to earn a decent living for their families that's at issue here too. And if we could all just get a little bit smarter in realizing when we're being hoodwinked or when we're signing an agreement with a country that shows no respect for its agreements. For example, just give you the most obvious example: the United States has an agreement with China. They will not import anything made by forced labor. Well, they had this law for about 20 years, and nobody bothered to enforce it. I asked somebody here in New Zealand a number of years ago, if they had a free trade agreement with China, how are they going to keep forced labor-made goods out of the country? And I'll remember his answer for a long time. He said, oh, we're going to have an inspector in Beijing. I almost fell off my chair laughing. It was, you know, such a foolish comment. So we've all got to get smarter about everything. And above all, we've got to get more determined about stopping this terrible crime against humanity in China. Sorry, another speech.
Yeah, no, well said, well said.
Just to finish up then, Robin, have you got any final comments?
Yeah, I think the key point about the government responses is not a question of political will, it's really a question of political won't. They won't act, mm-hmm. they won't do anything that's going to have what they perceive to be economic consequences, and so human rights is trumped by economic considerations mm-hmm. once again. I think something which we raised earlier, which we need to reiterate, is the use of terminology. And when one is campaigning purely to raise the level of public awareness of the outrage happening, one has to be careful that one doesn't use terms that soften the blow. So I say, for example, organ harvesting. Harvesting is a nice positive term. Harvesting food, it should be organ removal. When you talk about executions, yeah. we're not talking about formal executions of criminals, we're talking about informal executions of dissidents as yep. well. So in other words, the choice of your terminology is very important, because the people trying to defend or deflect the arguments will take every opportunity to raise straw man arguments in order to avoid the real issue, and that is the murder of people on demand for the organs.
Yeah, we mustn't underestimate the power of language. As we've seen in the recent election, this sort of Orwellian doublespeak has become quite prevalent throughout society now, and I think we do have to be very careful about what terminology we use. I really agree with you, Robin.
I've been calling this show organ harvesting. Maybe we need to think about calling it something else. Anyway, that seems
the only problem, I couldn't agree more with you, Robin, but the problem with using the word pillaging, I'm told, is that a lot of people who don't have English as their first language don't understand that word, and harvesting's been used for so long now that there is a sort of an awareness of it. But I agree with you, pillaging is the better word. It's more accurate word.
Perhaps you just make a point about that. Even pillaging has got a medieval context to it, of a sense of vague mayhem. It hasn't got that sense of people being murdered and their organs being removed. Even the organ harvesting has usually been used in the sense of people collecting organs from willing donors, not in the sense of people being murdered for the organs. So I think some straight talking is going to be needed.
Yeah.
Okay.
Well,
you notice we call our website organpillaging.org. So,
okay. Unfortunately, guys, we're running out of time.
Thank you, Sally, so much. And thank you, Jay. And thank you, Robert, so much for this.
Yeah, nice meeting you all.
Yeah, thank you very much.
Thanks, guys.
Okay. Bye for now.
To our listeners, check out our Facebook page for some of these links.